From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Doctors often prescribe vasodilators to keep arteries open in the brain, yet aspirin can be just as effective. On today's Fresh Air, the role of drug companies, doctors, science, and the FDA in the prescription drugs we take. We talk with Dr. Jerry Avorn, author of Powerful Medicines. Also, filmmaker Ross McElwee. His new documentary, Bright Leaves, explores his ancestors' involvement in the tobacco industry and tobacco addiction in the modern South. One reviewer describes the film as an engaging mixture of family album, social history, and human eccentricity. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A rebellious Shiite Muslim cleric has apparently accepted an Iraqi National Conference plan to end the fighting in the southern Iraqi city of Najaf. NPR's Ivan Watson says the plan is designed to bring Shiite militants into the political process.
Spokesmen for rebel Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr say he has accepted the demands made by the Iraqi National Conference. It called for three things. It said Muqtada al-Sadr must abandon, his militia must abandon the holy city of Najaf and the sacred shrine of Imam Ali. They have been fortified in and around that area in their two-week-long battle against the U.S. military and Iraqi government forces. The movement must convert itself into a peaceful political party and rejoin the political process here in Baghdad, and in exchange for this, they will receive immunity, Sadr and his supporters, from future prosecution.
NPR's Ivan Watson reporting from Baghdad. 5 days after Hurricane Charley tore through the Florida Peninsula, power has been restored to all but 430,000 people in the hardest-hit communities. At one point, well over a million people were in the dark. Now, residents are looking for help to start the rebuilding process. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
Storm victims have been sifting through the rubble left by Hurricane Charley and trying to piece their lives back together, many in sweltering heat with no electricity to power air conditioners or fans. State officials say more than 43,000 Floridians are seeking emergency assistance, funds that can be used for food, clothing, and temporary housing to replace what was lost in the storm. Some 16,000 people have applied for loans to rebuild homes and businesses. Residents returning to barrier islands off Fort Myers are finding the damage not as severe as they feared. Sanibel and Captiva Islands opened for the first time since being evacuated before the storm Friday. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Sarasota, Florida.
Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry spoke at the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Cincinnati today. He criticized the president's plan to bring U.S. troops home from bases in Europe and Asia.
The president's vaguely stated plan does not strengthen our hand in the war on terror. It in no way relieves the strain on our overextended military personnel. It doesn't even begin until 2006, and it takes 10 years to achieve.
President Bush campaigned in Wisconsin today. He promised supporters that he would increase federal education and job training benefits for military reservists and National Guard members. In stocks today, the Dow gained 110 points, or more than 1.1%, to close at 10,083. The Nasdaq was up 36 to 1831. This is NPR News. The Securities and Exchange Commission has given the go-ahead to Google for its initial public offering. That could happen as soon as tomorrow morning. Still, the Internet search company will not offer as many shares as it initially anticipated. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
It's been a rocky road to the finish for Google. The company caused a stir with its use of a Dutch auction to open up the process, which is usually limited to investors connected to investment banks. But it drew criticism when it initially priced the shares well above $100 and likely beyond the reach of many individual investors. Google lowered the share price, but other clouds hovered over the anticipated IPO. An interview with the founders appeared in Playboy magazine during the SEC-enforced quiet period leading up to the offering. Google also revealed that millions of its pre-IPO shares and options were issued to employees and contractors without being registered. The SEC is now investigating. Nonetheless, analysts admit the company remains popular and prosperous. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Federal officials say U.S. air carriers have agreed to cut some flights into Chicago's O'Hare International Airport in an effort to ease congestion at the nation's busiest landing site. The deal calls for major airlines to reduce their flights into O'Hare by about 20% during the airport's busiest hours. United Airlines agreed to reduce its traffic into the airport by 20 flights, and American Airlines promised to cut 17 flights from November to April. The Federal Aviation Administration says about a third of all flights at O'Hare are delayed by congestion, and that the delays affect the nation's entire air traffic system. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment. At visa.com/signature.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The French philosopher Voltaire once said, "Medicine is something prescribed by a doctor while waiting for nature to cure the illness." Our guest, Dr. Jerry Avorn, doesn't believe that, but his new book argues that doctors often prescribe medicines that don't work or cost too much, that drug companies spend a fortune peddling incomplete or even misleading information, and that the federal government does too little to find out and tell us which medicines work and which may cause harm. Jerry Avorn is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard, and he supervises drug research at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He spent 25 years treating patients and studying medication use and outcomes. His new book is Powerful Medicines: The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. Jerry Avorn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You open your book with a very clever pharmaceutical riddle. You tell us a story that in a former British colony, healers believed in the wisdom that a distillation of fluids extracted from the urine of horses, if reduced to a powder and fed to aging women, would ward off all kinds of diseases and preserve youth. And this became widely used by the healers throughout the culture. And it was only many years later that modern science revealed that, in fact, this horse urine extract was useless for most of its intended purposes and, in fact, caused tumors, blood clots, heart disease, and maybe even brain damage. Solve the riddle. What is the former British colony and the drug at work here?
Well, the former British colony is the United States of America, and the drug that I'm talking about there is all the various estrogen replacement treatments, such as Premarin and Prempro, that were used by so many millions of Americans for decades. And what I was trying to do in putting it in that context was there's sometimes a mystique that develops about medications in the U.S. that they are high science and we know everything about them and that hardly anything can go wrong because they've been so well studied, whereas we think of primitive cultures as having these potions that don't usually do anything and can hurt you. And while that is more true of than not, it's important to realize that sometimes things can go in exactly the opposite direction. And the estrogen replacement story is a striking example, although an exceptional example, of how we can have treatments that are really not based on any good science that actually can hurt people.
It's remarkable that just doctors everywhere were prescribing this in huge, huge amounts.
Sure, I was too. I was a big believer because that was the culture, certainly when I was starting out in practice in the 70s and well into the 80s and into the 90s. That was the gospel. Every smart doctor knew that when a woman went through the menopause, you put her on hormone replacement therapy. That was just the right thing. It turns out it wasn't.
Well, the drug manufacturers told us that there was data, I mean, to support comparative studies, which showed, in fact, that women that were on this stuff did better in a whole lot of indices of health than women who weren't. What was wrong with that information?
Well, the problem was that this was all what we call observational data. That is, many studies, very carefully done, involving thousands and thousands of women, found that women who were estrogen users turned out to have less heart disease and less other problems, like less Alzheimer's and less depression and less incontinence than women of the same age and medical background who were not users of estrogen. And that was pretty compelling. And as I said, I was convinced along with everybody else. The one group that wasn't convinced of this, we should say, was the FDA. They held to their high standard, which they were very correct in doing, that it had never really been shown in a randomized clinical trial in which women were arbitrarily assigned to take hormone replacement therapy for years and years, and other women were arbitrarily assigned to take a dummy pill that looked just like it but was actually placebo or inactive. And that's the only grounds on which FDA will approve a product. And in fact, FDA never approved estrogen for the use of protecting your heart or preventing Alzheimer's or any of those other reasons that we now know actually are not true.
So the studies that did compare women who took estrogen to those who didn't, they were measuring something. What were they telling us?
Right. They were literally correct that the women who chose to remain on estrogen for many, many years did actually have less heart disease and less of these other problems than the women who were not estrogen takers. We now understand, now that there finally was a federally funded randomized trial where it was done exactly as I said a minute ago, and there was no difference. In fact, there may even have been worse outcomes in the estrogen users in some measures. We now understand that a woman who will seek out estrogen replacement therapy and then stick with the regimen and take it year in and year out is fundamentally a different kind of person clinically than somebody who doesn't, whether because the woman who's the estrogen user has more access to health care or is more careful about her health, and maybe she's also taking blood pressure pills and watching her weight and her diet and getting exercise and not smoking. All those things, which we do know prevent heart disease, were kind of traveling along with estrogen use when it was studied in this observational way. And we now understand that it was a phenomenon of selection bias. That is, the women who chose to be on estrogen were different from the ones who, in the scheme of things, chose not to be. And when you randomly allocate people in a trial for the first time, we found out as late as 2002 that actually it doesn't do what we thought it did.
Well, and you conclude, quoting from your book, that tens of thousands of extra breast cancers, pulmonary emboli, strokes, and other related side effects didn't need to happen.
That's right. Now that we do have, for a couple of years now, this well-done federally funded clinical trial, we can actually count up how many extra heart attacks and breast cancers there were in a very rigorous way, because women were arbitrarily assigned to take estrogen or placebo, and we know precisely how many extra cases of cancer and other problems resulted. And it's staggering. It's one of the larger drug-induced epidemics, if you will, of modern times.
Let's talk a bit about the role of drug companies in influencing what doctors prescribe. You write that one of your very first research studies, maybe even your first, involved a look at why doctors prescribe Darvon, and then also another class of drug, which is designed, I guess, to keep arteries open in the brain, cerebral and peripheral vasodilators, right?
That's right.
Now, what did this study tell you? What did you find?
Well, what was striking about those drugs, and we also looked at an antibiotic that was overused because people were giving it for viral infections where it had no effect. And I picked those drugs because they had one property in common. They were horrendously overused. In the purposes for which they were used, they were either ineffective or no better than other alternatives you could get over the counter. So, for example, Darvon is really not much better than aspirin or Tylenol, for that matter. And yet they were selling like hotcakes. And the question that I was trying to answer was, why is it that doctors are using these drugs that are either ineffective or no better than something that you can get without a prescription? And so we asked doctors what their perceptions of these drugs were, and sure enough, they told us exactly what the drug ads said to them about efficacy and about advantage over other products. And we also asked them, where do you get your information from about drugs in general? And although doctors believed that they were not being influenced by ads or sales reps or any of the massive promotional material that they see, in fact, what they believed about the drugs could only have come from those commercial promotional channels, because there was no article in any medical journal that really ever said that these drugs did what they believed they did. And so it was a sobering instance of a lot of us believe what we or know what we know because of pharmaceutical promotion rather than because we read it in a textbook or a medical journal.
Anybody who's sat in a waiting room knows that doctors are very busy people. And in addition to treating patients and looking at lab reports and writing in files, there's a dizzying array of information that comes through medical journals and the websites about all kinds of things, including prescription drugs. You describe, I think, in your book, you call it informational kudzu, this kind of vine that just spreads everywhere and multiplies.
Right.
How do doctors sort out what to know? And I guess the real question, I mean, you've pointed at this, is how do the drug companies seek to influence them?
Well, one of the major themes in Powerful Medicines is that, unfortunately, there's a lot of very effective communication coming at us as prescribers that is oriented around product sales, but there is much, much less information coming at us around just the best available science. And again, the reasons are that there's an enormous amount of capital behind trying to get us to use the latest and most flashy, expensive brand name product, and coming along and saying, well, gee, there's a generic drug that's been around for 20 years or more that works just as well, is not a message that anyone is paid to deliver for the most part. And so one of the difficulties is that doctors are inundated with messages about use this latest and greatest and most fancy new product because that's where the profit margins are. And yet the older story is not as well told. And sometimes, as we saw with another big federal study that came out just 2 years ago, for blood pressure pills, when you really do the randomized head-to-head comparison, the older generic cheap drugs not only are as good as, but in fact work better than some of the new high-priced drugs. And yet it's no one's job to get at that information to doctors.
Now, apart from the information itself, what techniques do the drug companies actually use to get doctors' attention?
Well, that's a great question because it was the next logical question after it became clear in looking at what doctors were prescribing that it seemed that our pens were being guided more by promotional sources than they were by pure science. So the question is, how did this happen? And I began a study of what it is that pharmaceutical companies do to influence our prescribing, and they're awfully good at it. They're very creative, very talented, and very effective. They will come into our offices with a message instead of, as we do in academics, expecting someone to turn up in a lecture hall to listen to us.
Let's be real concrete. I mean, when you say they come and talk to you, I mean, does a guy with a coat and a tie and a suitcase full of drugs show up at a doctor's office, and does the doctor give him the time?
Sure. We can take some example. The high blood pressure pills that many listeners may actually be taking. If we are thinking about the older thiazide diuretics, which have been around since the 1950s, they are all off patent for the most part. They are not advertised that much. There is not a lot of money to be made off of them because they're all generic and the profit margins are low. And so it's really, there's no one out there trying to convince me as a practitioner that I should use these drugs. And if you contrast that with, let's say, the calcium channel blockers, which are the drugs that really took over market share from these older, more inexpensive drugs in the 1990s, what we have is an army of very well-dressed, friendly people called detail men or detail women because they provide the doctor with the details about the drug. And there are tens of thousands of these people working all over the country, and a busy doctor will be visited on a given day by many, many of them. And each one will be hawking the wares of the company that he or she works for and will come to my office and give me free samples, which will get my attention, may give me various kinds of tchotchkes like a pen or a notepad or perhaps tickets to a Red Sox game or to a play, or perhaps will invite me to a seminar at the best restaurant in town where I've got to listen to their talk and then have a wonderful meal. And the materials themselves will catch my attention because they've got big headlines and color graphs and a simple take-home message, and that really will run circles around the kind of papers that I would write as an academic, which are likelier to be much more staid and don't have big headlines or color pictures with them. And what we've learned in our research, and a number of other people have learned, is that the listeners may well be on a calcium channel blocker rather than an older thiazide diuretic because there's lots of people telling their doctors to use the expensive drugs, and nobody's out there saying, use these other ones. They work just as good.
My guest is Dr. Jerry Avorn. His new book is called Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Dr. Jerry Avorn. He's a physician who spent years researching prescription drugs, and he has a new book. It's called Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. You know, doctors, I think we think of as pretty ethical people. I mean, and I know one family physician who will remain forever my wife, who She with her colleagues made a no-free lunch rule finally in their practice because the drug companies were typically coming in and making a nice pasta spread, which the support staff really enjoyed. The doctors got together and decided, you know what, we'll chip in once a week, we'll buy lunch for the staff, but we're simply not going to take any more free lunches from drug reps. Is there a movement among physicians to think about this differently?
Yes, there is. At my own hospital here in Boston, the Brigham and Women's, a number of years ago, the interns and residents got together and asked the hospital to please not allow the drug companies to buy the pizza for pizza rounds on Friday afternoons, and instead ask that my division buy it because they knew that we would be providing unbiased information in exchange for the pizza instead of having an obligatory sales rep or a set of brochures staring them in the face as they were trying to have their pizza. And our hospital has been pretty good at trying to keep drug companies out as the purveyors of medical education. We figure all of us are on the Harvard Medical School faculty. We really should be ashamed of ourselves if we need to have drug company sales reps coming in to teach our trainees how to prescribe drugs.
You have a proposal for, in effect, competing with the drug reps, right? How does it work?
Well, when it became clear to me that we were simply not getting our point across as academics and as medical school faculty anywhere near as compellingly as the drug companies were, I reasoned that maybe the reason that we were doing so poorly at it, and if you just look at prescribing data, the science was not winning out as well as it ought to, was that we just were not as good at the game of communication as the drug companies are. And so a number of years ago, I came up with this concept that came to be known as academic detailing, which is taking that very, very effective behavior change strategy that the drug companies are so good at, sending people to the doctor's office, giving them engaging materials, doing an interactive one-on-one conversation instead of just standing in a darkened room and giving lectures the way most of my colleagues and I do. We deployed a team of what we called academic detailers, who were pharmacists that we sent out to teach doctors how to prescribe better using the same tools as the drug company uses to get doctors to sell their product for them, basically. And so these folks would go into doctors' offices and say, hi, I'm from the Harvard Medical School Education Program, and do the same strategies as a sales rep would do. Be interactive, make sure you're coming to where the doctor's at cognitively as well as geographically, give them all the backup they need to change their behavior. And what we found was that by using that outreach approach, we were able to reduce inappropriate prescribing very effectively, and that the program actually ended up costing less than it saved in terms of silly prescribing dollars. And so that approach is now taking off and has been implemented in a variety of settings, both in the U.S. and abroad.
So do you see a way for a national army of these independent drug detailers to get out there and give better information?
Well, when I was first asked that question years ago, I would say yes, and people would say, what a quaint idea for a pointy-headed academic to believe in. But in the years since we published that first paper in the New England Journal, exactly that has occurred. There is now a nationwide program in Australia that is based on this work and the work of other groups that have been doing this, in which the Australian government pays a fleet of pharmacists to go door-to-door to doctors and to provide them with unbiased information about the best available science based on this idea of being user-friendly and interactive. And the information is not determined by the government. It's determined by an independent board of physician experts. The government just pays the bill to send these people out there. And similar programs are on the ground and functioning now in the United Kingdom and in several provinces in Canada. And we're about to launch a program of this kind in the state of Pennsylvania. Another large program of this kind is getting off the ground this summer in Kentucky. And so what we're seeing is kind of a pushback from, I guess, the world of science and the world of those who are trying to make sure the drugs are affordable, saying we should not leave the education of doctors about drugs solely or predominantly in the hands of those who are manufacturing the drugs. And it's taking hold.
Let's talk a little bit about drug studies and what they tell us, what they don't tell us, and how they're used. A lot of the research about medications is done by drug companies themselves. Can they fund studies and then, if they don't like the results, keep them secret? Or can they publish studies but only publish partial results? What restrictions or regulations are there which govern the way drug studies are conducted and used?
Well, Dave, I think your first point is a very important one that most Americans and, frankly, most physicians may not be aware of, that the FDA does not study drugs hardly at all itself, and that essentially all the information that it has available in making decisions about drugs is based on studies that were really done by and run by the manufacturer of that drug. Now, this is often done carefully and rigorously, but we've seen in just the last couple of months that it can sometimes happen that a company will heavily promote the findings of studies that it likes and be much more quiet to the point of almost burying the findings of studies whose results it doesn't like. And the scandal of the moment on that of a few weeks ago was a company that makes an antidepressant. And when it found that its product performed well in adolescents with depression, that study was all over the airwaves that doctors were exposed to. But another study that was also a randomized clinical trial in which it found that the patients given their antidepressant didn't do well and, in fact, may have had a worrisome increase in their suicide rate was buried, and it just kind of appeared in one Danish textbook that no one ever read. And so there is this asymmetry, and while FDA reserves the right to find out about all those results, it's not allowed to report them because it's seen as proprietary information. And so we've seen an imbalance of what does get out to doctors.
So a drug company can literally keep secret results which reveal harmful effects or ineffectiveness?
Well, they are obliged to tell it to FDA, and FDA is then responsible for figuring out what to do with it. If there were a really egregious problem, like the drug was causing immediate fatalities, I would like to believe that the company and the FDA would do something about it. But if it's the real issue is the much more common situation where the drug just doesn't perform so good, or it's got a higher rate of adverse events than was expected or than its competitor drugs have. And that kind of finding, the FDA is not obliged to release if it does not turn out to be a major new discovery, but is really just a matter of balance. But of course, everything in prescribing is a matter of balance.
I think that would surprise a lot of people. I think most people would think that somewhere all of the information that the FDA has about the safety or efficacy of drugs would be available to physicians. It's not.
What drives prescribing is what is brought to the physician's attention in an effective way that'll change use. And the fact that there may or may not be something that lives on a computer disk in FDA is not going to influence prescribing as much as something that is hammered home with a variety of lectures and cruises and free dinners and other things. And that is what drives prescribing. And that's where we need a more neutral voice out there trying to give doctors a balanced view, not this free enterprise chaos in which we have every company hawking its own wares to the extent that it will profit. And companies that are not going to profit who make generic drugs are not out there hawking at all.
Dr. Jerry Avorn. His new book is called Powerful Medicines. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the FDA standard for putting a drug on the market. We continue our conversation with Dr. Jerry Avorn, author of Powerful Medicines. Also, filmmaker Ross McElwee. His new documentary, Bright Leaves, tells the story of how his ancestors just missed making a fortune in the tobacco business, and their descendants became doctors treating patients with smoking-related illness. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to my conversation with Dr. Jerry Avorn, who spent 25 years treating patients and studying prescription drugs. His new book is Powerful Medicines: The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. What standard does the FDA hold to allow a drug to get on the market?
This, again, will surprise many listeners, because the belief that I had before I started looking into this was that there was that a new drug needed to have some important medical virtue to it before it was going to be added to the list of drugs that can be sold in the U.S. It turns out that it really doesn't need to be any better than all the other drugs we've got. It doesn't even need to be compared to any other drug. And it can simply be compared in many cases to a inert pill like a placebo for as short as perhaps 16 weeks of study. And the outcome of interest that the trial is going to be based on may be not did it reduce strokes or did it prevent heart attacks, but did it make your lab values better from a point of view of a cholesterol drug, or did it lower your blood pressure temporarily? Or in the case of diabetes, did it make your blood sugar lower? That's plausible, but we don't know, since these are drugs that people are going to take for a lifetime, whether a new drug that is approved on that basis is really going to be worth having around for the next 10 years if it's a lifelong drug based on a 16-week study compared against placebo. And unfortunately, you pass that test and that's enough to get your drug approved. And then it's nobody's job to take the next step and say, well, okay, this diabetes drug is better than a sugar pill or an inert pill in making your blood sugar lower, but does that mean that I, as a doctor, ought to switch to it? I don't have the data when I'm writing a prescription to be able to know that, because the FDA only requires that it be tested for a couple of months against an inert substance.
Well, by that standard, I mean, couldn't the drug Premarin, the estrogen replacement, which was taken off the market because of its potential harmful effects, I mean, it did have some beneficial effects on some health indices. I mean, by that standard, could Premarin be marketed today?
Yes. In fact, it is still used for the temporary management of menopausal symptoms, and it does work well for that, for the hot flashes and the immediate problems when a woman is going through the menopause. What it was never tested for was the lifelong use that accounted for virtually the lion's share of its use.
Does the FDA have a mandate to prosecute or take action against drug companies that make unfounded claims about their products?
FDA is very careful in making sure that companies don't make unfounded claims. They are less careful than they used to be. In fact, in the Bush administration, one of the early acts of the new general counsel at FDA was to announce that they would no longer as aggressively pursue problematic claims made by drug companies in their ads. And in fact, the number of enforcement actions has gone down over earlier years because of this let's not overregulate industry kind of orientation that we now have. But if you read the ads very carefully, again, to come back to the estrogen example, the ads never exactly said this drug will prevent heart disease or this drug will make it less likely that you'll get Alzheimer's disease. The ads really stuck more or less to the letter of the law, saying this is good for the treatment of menopausal symptoms. And all the heavy lifting for those other messages happened in various continuing education courses or speakers bureaus that the manufacturer would sponsor, where doctors who had friendly messages to the drug would be paid to go around the country and give talks in hospitals and medical schools. And the company itself was careful trying not to cross the line as best it could into making false claims, because they let other people do that for them.
You write that Americans spend a lot more on prescription drugs than other industrialized countries. Give us a sense of what the difference is and what the health impact is.
Americans pay anywhere between 40% and 100% more for the same drugs made by the same companies as do people in other parts of the world. And I'm thinking here of Canada and Western Europe. And ironically, these are the same plants making the same products and purveyed by the same companies. It's just that most other industrialized countries manage to keep a lid on what is charged for drugs, and the U.S. is really the last industrialized country that allows this to be totally what the traffic will bear. And if a patient is told by their doctor, you need a certain drug, and it costs them $1,000 a year, they're going to have a hard time saying no, because after all, my doctor said I should take it. And that's why the U.S. pays so much more for drugs than any other country per capita.
one of the things the drug companies say, of course, is, you know, yes, we have huge revenues, but if you want research and development to cure new diseases and treat all kinds of problems that we can't treat today, that's going to cost a lot of money. Do they have a point?
Well, in the book, I call that the research ultimatum. That is, if we cannot make lavish profits, we're just going to stop discovering new drugs and you're all going to die. And I think that that's an overstated claim by the industry for a couple of reasons. One is that the industry is one of the most profitable for most of the last 20 years. It has been the single most profitable industry of any industry group in the country. And in fact, far more dollars get plowed back into promotional activities and marketing or into just profits for shareholders than get plowed back into research and development. There are more folks working in the big drug companies doing marketing and sales than there are doing research at present. And in fact, an awful lot of the most important findings that lead to new drugs are done in university settings, and they're funded by the National Institutes of Health or other federal-supported programs or private philanthropies. And so the idea that somehow the drug companies are the only source of important biomedical research that leads to new drugs is simply not true.
To be concrete, I mean, how big of a cut of the cost of drugs goes to the sales and marketing effort?
Well, this was looked at by the Department of Health and Human Services, which is not exactly a rabidly anti-industry group these days. And they found in looking at the filings of the 9 or 10 biggest drug companies in the U.S. that about 30% of their total revenues is devoted to marketing, promotion, and administration. So that's about nearly a third. About 20% is devoted to profit, that is, goes back to the shareholders, and only about 13% is for research and development. And so that's a rather disproportionate amount that's not going to R&D for the drug dollars that we are spending. And it's probably a very inefficient way for us to discover new drugs compared to other alternatives.
What's your attitude towards people going to Canada to get drugs and getting them from Canadian internet sites?
The FDA has done a lot of scare tactics about this, but in fact, Canada is a very civilized country, and it is not difficult for FDA to certify Canadian pharmacies or Canadian vendors, just as it certifies vendors for drugs in America. And the irony is these are not weird drugs made in a bathtub in Bangladesh. These are usually the same drugs made by the same companies in the same factories as Americans buy. They just aren't marked up as much. And it would be quite easy for FDA to be able to certify FDA-approved Canadian pharmacies or British pharmacies or French pharmacies that would get us the medications we need. And they're not doing it not because of medical reasons but because of political reasons.
What do you like or not like about the prescription drug plan that the administration has passed and Congress has approved?
Okay. The difficulty we're going to see, and we've already started to see with the new Medicare drug benefit, is that the policy was pretty much written by the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry, and it works very well for them. I don't think it's going to work very well for the nation's elderly because it doesn't contain in it any way in which we can try and get doctors to make sure that we're prescribing the most cost-effective drug for the elderly patients that we see. And for that reason, the costs are just going to balloon out of control, and it's going to be a fiscal disaster before it's 6 months old, I predict.
One of the points you make in your book is that that of all the drug studies that are done out there, that nobody seems to have an interest in doing a clinical trial which asks the question, is the new, fancier, more expensive drug really more effective than the established, cheaper one? That sort of nobody has an interest in doing that kind of study. And it occurs that one people that might have an interest in that kind of information would be an HMO or a big insurance company that pays the cost and could save a lot of money if they could prescribe cheaper drugs. Why don't they fund these kinds of studies?
That is a great question that I've been perplexed by for the last 20 years or so. There's a number of groups out there with very deep pockets that are spending enormous sums that they really are having trouble affording on drugs. It's not just the HMOs. It's also the Veterans Administration. It's also the state Medicaid programs. And soon it will be the Medicare program itself. And I've wondered for decades, why is it that with all of the billions of dollars that these payers are spending paying for drugs, that they're not mounting these studies? And I think it comes down to the sense that they fear that FDA is minding the store and that somehow this work will get done by somebody else. And the big problem is that it isn't getting done. And we probably will be seeing, as this gets more and more out of control, a new stream of research coming online in which there will be these very clinically relevant studies that do get done. Who will fund them is not yet clear. But we've got to have somebody out there, and it's not going to be the companies, when a new drug comes out that's supposed to be better than the old stuff, actually testing that in a clinical trial, because we can't go on just always adding the new drugs to the prescription pad without ever asking, as any prudent payer would, is the incremental cost that I'm going to have to shell out for this getting me in any kind of incremental benefit? So we've got a big gap in our science policy in this area.
Well, Jerry Avorn, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jerry Avorn. His new book is Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. Coming up, Tobacco Wars in the Old South. We meet documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee. This is Fresh Air. Documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee lives in Boston and teaches filmmaking at Harvard, but he grew up in North Carolina, and many of his films involve journeys back to his native South. In Sherman's March, McElwee pursued seven Southern women looking for love. In his new film, Bright Leaves, McElwee tells the story of his ancestors' involvement with the tobacco industry. The film is in part a reflection on tobacco and tobacco addiction in the modern South. McElwee begins with a fascinating piece of family lore. His great-grandfather, John Harvey McElwee, was a 19th-century tobacco grower and was the first to come up with the popular Bull Durham blend. But the family story has it that the McElwees lost their patent and potential fortune to the famous Duke family of North Carolina. In this scene from Bright Leaves, McElwee introduces us to his second cousin, a small-town lawyer and vintage film buff named John McElwee. He's discovered an old Hollywood movie called Bright Leaf, a melodrama about a rivalry among post-Civil War tobacco growers.
The author of the novel on which the movie was based was also from North Carolina, did the research based on stories involving North Carolina tobacco growers, and it just seems very likely that that our great-grandfather's story had to have been incorporated into this, and I think really it's the basic theme of this movie. It's the same. What happened to our great-grandfather is pretty much what happens to Gary Cooper in this film.
Who are the co-stars with Gary Cooper in this?
Lauren Bacall and Patricia Neal, Donald Crisp, Jack Carson.
So this was a major production.
Oh yeah. Yeah, this was an A feature. Directed by Michael Curtiz. He had done Casablanca, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Adventures of Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. He's Warner's top director at the time.
With our great grandfather being featured.
Exactly.
Gary Cooper, incredible.
That's right.
I asked Ross McElwee how his great-grandfather lost the Bull Durham tobacco patent.
Well, we don't know exactly what happened, but somehow he lost control of that trademark. I think by simply reversing Bull Durham to Durham Bull, or his original phrase was Durham Bull, and that somehow became switched to Bull Durham. They just flip-flopped the phrase. And that became the name of a very popular brand of tobacco. At one point, during the height of the popularity of this kind of tobacco, they had an image of the Durham Bull draped over one of the great pyramids of Egypt. So this thing was a worldwide phenomenon. Bullpen, the phrase in baseball where the pitchers warm up, is named bullpen because pitchers used chewing tobacco, and one of the tobaccos they favored was Bull Durham. And so that, the fact that it was so popular and had earned so much money for the Dukes, and is something that my family has always had to kind of wrestle with.
Well, I wonder what your lawyers thought about a film which appeared to depict the notion that this prominent and successful family had in effect cheated your family out of its rightful due. I mean, is that in fact what happened?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think it's ever been that simple, and it's never been proven. It went through legal procedures, the whole case did, and many, many different trials, I think, occurred in which this issue was debated by, you know, a judge and a jury and so forth. And the legal outcome of all of those cases was that my great-grandfather did not have the right to the trademark. And I think the family long ago accepted that. And I think what was interesting to me was that hypothetically, if we did still control this tobacco fortune, how would that affect us? How would that affect me? And I think it was just a kind of, it was a way in which I could begin to explore part of the ethical paradox of having that kind of a family fortune.
And one of the interesting things, of course, is that your family gets out of the tobacco business and produces a string of doctors who treat North Carolinians damaged by tobacco.
Yes, that's true. And I think I allude to that in the film as a kind of agricultural pathological trust fund that was left for my family, given that there was no family fortune inherited, but there was this awful other legacy. But I do want to say that I don't think the film has a tone of condemnation for the tobacco industry, nor for the people who grow tobacco. I'm really trying to do something much more complex than that. It's such a delicate issue for North Carolina. It's not simply a matter of saying that all tobacco should cease to be grown now. I think that that would put a lot of people out of work, and that North Carolina is trying to deal with the problem, but that there is no simple solution. This crop is rooted into the economic and psychological history and of the state of North Carolina and of the people who live there. And so my film explores the complexity of that.
Bull Durham, tell us, where did that name come from? Was it a particular blend of tobacco, and did it have anything to do with a bull?
Actually, the story is that my great-grandfather and an associate of his, a guy named Green, ran a barn trying to think of what to call this concoction, and they heard a bull bellowing off on the horizon somewhere in this farmland of North Carolina, and my great-grandfather said, ah, that's what we'll call it, bull. And they liked Durham because there was kind of mustard that was imported from England at the time that was called Durham, and for no particular reason, they just put those two words together, and in fact, it became quite successful as a trademark.
And lives on in a famous movie about minor league baseball.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that that tobacco and its role in North Carolina society and culture is something which is evolving. And one interesting piece of that, late in the film, you visit a small town which has, I guess, a tobacco festival in which there are beauty queens. And it's the last one, right?
It is the last official tobacco festival in that particular town. They're in the process of changing it over to something called Farmer's Day, in which it won't just be a celebration of tobacco, but of all crops grown in the area. But it's, you know, in a way, it's a little bit sad. This festival has existed for 50 years, has always been called the Tobacco Day Festival, and was changing its name at this point. So I think it's very much a mark of changing times in North Carolina that happened to have been in that town and have filmed what essentially was the last parade in a 50-year history of parades celebrating tobacco.
You discover what used to be a tobacco warehouse of your great-grandfather, I gather, which is now a beauty shop or a beauty college, something like that, right?
Yes, it's a hair academy, as I say, down in North Carolina. Yes, and in this warehouse where, you know, my great-grandfather's tobacco had been piled high at one point. There are now people learning to how to tease hair, I guess, or dye hair. And I liked very much the paradox of that it had gone from being a kind of warehouse where tobacco was gathered together and sent out, and now it had become a beauty parlor. And I ended up filming some of the beauticians on their cigarette break and had sort of an amusing exchange with them about when they were going to quit smoking, and they tell me various things.
What did you hear in their answers that illuminated that question you had about why people take up smoking and sort of dance with the risks that it brings?
Well, I think that it connects to a very essential part of human nature, which is that of denial, that these young women, they were probably 18 or 19 years old, were saying that they would quit smoking when they had children, or one of them says, I'll quit smoking when I, you know, have lung cancer. I mean, they're making jokes about that. But in a way, the humor of that, I think, for me, underscores something much more profound, which is the degree to which people are capable of denial. And we're all capable of denial. We have to be in order to keep living, because we all die. And I think the cigarette smoking, again, kind of focuses this in a wonderful, wonderfully metaphorical way, you know, how we deal with the fact that existentially with the fact that our lives come to an end. And smoking, in a way, I think, pushes that to the forefront, makes you deal with it or makes you deny it.
Filmmaker Ross McElwee, his latest documentary is called Bright Leaves. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee. His new film, Bright Leaves, deals with his family's history in the North Carolina tobacco industry. You also spoke to tobacco farmers who, you know, seemed like very decent people, who in an information age know an awful lot about the hazards and misery that smoking has brought. It was an interesting contrast to see these nice folks talking about something with, you know, death-dealing qualities.
Yes, well, I think the thing that I ended up, the qualities that I ended up respecting in these people were their sincerity and also the fact that they were at least acknowledging, most of them, that there was a paradox here and that they did have to eventually come to deal with it. And I think that just the fact that they can acknowledge the fact that there's a paradox here, that there are things about smoking that that are threatening and dangerous to people, means that they're beginning to face the issue in some way, or at least the farmers that I spoke to were beginning to face the issue. And I think also what interested me about them was the degree to which they were so religious, and somehow there was no contradiction, no paradox in their religiosity with the fact that they were growing something that was potentially dangerous to people. But the other thing the film explores is, I mean, part of what makes smoking such a complex issue is that I also film people who have been smoking since, there was one man I filmed who had been smoking since he was 4 years old, and he was in, you know, pretty good health, and he had had a grandmother who'd lived to be 109, and she had smoked all of her life. And so what makes it complicated is that, of course, genetically, smoking is not necessarily something that's going to bring your life to an early end. It probably will, it may, but it's not definite. And I think that little window of chance that you'll escape what most people succumb to if you smoke is another factor that makes denial possible.
As you explore the contrast between your own ancestors who were in the tobacco business and the Duke family, which became billionaires at it, You discover that while there is a Duke University and a Duke Medical School, there is a McElwee Park somewhere, right?
Yes. There is a McElwee Park that I had not heard of until I visited with a historian in Statesville, North Carolina, a local historian who revealed its presence to me. And it was this tiny little back lot connected to the manufacturing, the factory that my great-grandfather had built in Statesville, North Carolina, and some historical society had designated the land next to the factory as McElwee Park. And it's a rather, hurts me to say so, but a rather shabby affair. It has one little sign saying McElwee Park and then a single bench between two stunted trees. and this somehow qualifies as a park. And, you know, for me, it's a humorous or kind of comic emblem of what happened to the family fortune, and I return to it periodically to muse on the complexities of tobacco and fate during the course of the film.
Is there a moment, maybe when you were making Bright Leaves, when you say, yes, this is it, this is why documentary filmmaking is my love?
Those moments are what keep you going, making these films. These films are not easy to make, but it's those little moments of discovery. And I think for me, the moment, the scene, the day that most fulfilled exactly that quality that you're talking about was the tobacco parade that occurs at the end of the film, in which when I saw the sign indicating that it was the 50th tobacco parade in this little town in eastern North Carolina, I thought, well, this might be worth checking out. And the minute I started filming, I realized I was so happy that I began filming this, because it was just moment after moment of surprise in terms of the beauty queens who kept coming by, and there were so many of them, and then the preparations of the crown before the parade, and then there was this moment where these riding lawnmowers were kind of performing a precision movement of some kind in the parade itself, and there were all of these things that you could not have dreamt up if you had been writing a script of what a parade would have been like in this kind of a situation. And those are those moments when you just are so delighted to be a documentary filmmaker, because in fact you're not directing, you're just receiving what the world is handing to you. And I think that was certainly the scene that embodied that quality for me as a filmmaker.
Well, Ross McElwee, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, Dave.
Documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee. His latest film, Bright Leaves, opens next week at Film Forum in New York City. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, publisher of Retirement for Two, Everything You Need to Know to Thrive Together as Long as You Both Shall Live, by Marianne Vandervelde, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about civil war and human suffering in Western Sudan with Rowan Gillies, international president of Doctors Without Borders, and with John Prendergast, a special advisor to the International Crisis Group. Both were recently in Darfur, Sudan. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.